All right. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Margaret Bartley presiding. All of that business before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good afternoon. I'm Judge Bartley, and I'm joined today by Judge Peach and Judge Toth. And the court is convened today to hear the matter of Joseph Labruzza and Randall G. McBride versus Dennis McDonough, Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Dockets number 21-4467 and 20-8562. The issue before us is whether the past employment situations of Mr. Labruzza and Mr. McBride qualify as having taken place in a protected environment under 38 CFR 4.16 and related issues. Counsel for the parties, please state your name and your appearance for the record, beginning with appellant's counsel.
Barbara Cook, on behalf of appellant Joseph Labruzza, with me at counsel table is attorney Michael Mooney.
Thank you. Thank you. And Secretary's Counsel?
Laura Johnson for the Secretary. With me at counsel table is Mark Lutich.
Okay, thank you. And appellants will each have 20 minutes to present their arguments. The Secretary will have 30 minutes to present his argument. Ms. Cook, how much time would you like to reserve?
I'd like 5 minutes, Your Honor, please.
Thank you. And Mr. Murray?
4 minutes.
Okay. Thank you. And Ms. Cook, you may proceed on behalf of Appellant Labruzza.
Thank you, Chief Judge Bartley. Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Protected environments support the disabled person by lowering productivity expectations and tailoring them to the needs of the disabled person beyond what would be legally required in a competitive environment. That is a direct quotation from page 1 of the Secretary's supplemental pleading. Mr. Labruzza agrees with this aspect of the Secretary's interpretation of the rule. It, like the one Mr. Labruzza has offered the Court, recognizes that persons who receive accommodations in excess of those required by law are in a protected work environment. The Board did not meaningfully address whether the accommodations Mr. Labruzza received were excessive, and so we ask that the Court send the case back for consideration under this interpretation. An excessive accommodations-based interpretation. You look like you're going to ask me something, Judge Bartley. Okay, sorry. An excessive accommodations-based interpretation comes directly from the plain language and purpose of 4.16. That regulation draws a line between people who are eligible for TDIU, that is, those who are unable to perform the acts required by substantially gainful employment, and people who are not eligible for TDIU. That is, they can do the tasks required. The ADA's reasonable accommodation mandates defines where that line is between those two groups of people. Because the ADA required accommodations, that is, reasonable accommodations, enhance the imposition of the ADA on employers of the requirement of reasonable accommodations, enhances the ability of people with disabilities or veterans with disabilities to perform the acts required for substantially gainful employment. The disability, once reasonable accommodations are provided as required by the ADA, is no longer a barrier. And the ADA is a fact of life in the U.S. economy. It has expanded the availability of jobs and is... Yes, Judge Chose.
I mean, are excessive accommodations just more accommodations, or are they something fundamentally different from your ADA accommodations?
I think they're fundamentally different in the sense that they are accommodations that are not required by law. One might call them unreasonable accommodations, but I don't, I've shied away from using that term because I don't think any employer who is providing them is being unreasonable. But what the ADA sets up is reasonable accommodations are those that are do not create an undue burden on the employer. I mean, it's a fact-based assessment. But once an accommodation that is necessary, say a total job restructuring, or in the words of the ADA, removing essential functions of the job, then it crosses into a thing that employers are not required to provide under the ADA. And so that's what I'm referring to when I talk about excessive accommodations or over accommodations. There's lots of ways of putting it. Excessive, over accommodations, accommodations not required by law, accommodations that would create an undue burden on the employer. They all mean the same thing, that the employer is not required to provide them. And because the employer is not required to provide, no employer is required to provide an unreasonable or excessive accommodation, then people who have that demand.
Some practical examples of excessive accommodations.
An excessive accommodation. Sort of a classic example, I think, is the blind bus driver, right? I mean, the bus company, the bus driver can't drive the bus because of his blindness, but the bus company doesn't have to say, well, we're going to accommodate you and let you drive the bus anyway. But other accommodations, they tend to be in the category of things that create an undue burden. And so, for example, in Mr. LaBruzza's situation, one of the things that he explained was that he was unable to meet the deadlines. There was a 20-day deadline for submitting some documentation related to his job, and he was unable to do that. So he ended up hiring an assistant in order to meet those deadlines. That can be considered an excessive accommodation. He's no longer able to do that job and all the tasks required for the job.
To me, the accommodations would be relevant in the sense if it sheds light on the term protected environment, right? If it helps sort of resolve the interpretive dilemma of what a protected environment is, right? And so I'm trying to sort of follow that. If the accommodations are simply those which are beyond what's required under the ADA. How would that help us to kind of find a definition for this term protected environment?
Because by setting up this distinction between people who can work with reasonable accommodations and people who are not able to work even with reasonable accommodations, but we know that there are some people who are still getting paid, even though they cannot perform all the tasks required. All the essential tasks required by the job. And so those people are in a protected work environment. It helps also show the commonality among the concepts in the regulation itself, because the thing that sheltered workshop, working in a family business, and as subsets of a protected environment, what those all have in common is the employer's willingness to accept the fact that the employee is not performing all the essential tasks of the job.
How much of that is just having an understanding supervisor or like a lenient boss?
Some of it could very much be the result of a lenient supervisor or an understanding boss. People could have all sorts of motives for why employers, supervisors could have all kinds of motives for why they might accept the person not doing the essential functions of the job. But the test isn't doesn't start with what the employer's motive is. The test starts with what are the essential functions of the job? That's the ADA phrase, but the phrase from Ray and from Van Hoos is the ability to perform the tasks required for the job. It's the same concept. And so if the person is able, with reasonable accommodations, to perform the tasks required by the job at issue, then the person is not in a protected work environment. They're not entitled to TDIU.
But in Mr. LaBruzzo's case, what would the excessive accommodations be?
In Mr. LaBruzzo's situation, the excessive accommodations included the fact that he was another person was hired to help him actually do the required tasks, to help him meet the deadlines so that he didn't miss the deadlines. The excessive accommodations included the fact that he was his behavior was such that he was getting into arguments with people, he was having all sorts of interpersonal problems, to the extent that the township supervisor told him, if you weren't a veteran, you'd be fired. They weren't going to put up with that. Every job has certain required aspects of the job. And if the person isn't able to do them, but yet is still being paid, then they're being given
the wage that they're paid be considered in terms of figuring out something's a protected environment.
The income is definitely relevant because, in part because I think it shows or can show whether the person's skills. And let me back into that a little bit by noting that a person who's in a protected environment, it doesn't automatically mean that the person is eligible for TDIU because they also have to be unable to perform substantially gainful work. In other words, a surgeon who develops Parkinson's, service-connected Parkinson's, and can no longer do surgery. Well, that person can no longer do the essential functions of being a surgeon, but he likely can do other things, even given his knowledge, and so he might still be paid the same amount. So, yes, income is relevant, but VA, both at regulatory history, throughout, has acknowledged that income is not the dispositive factor. And I do think that it's unusual to see high income. I know in this case that the board noted that Mr. LaBruzzo one year reported $200,000, about $200,000 as income. The record is a little unclear. The page after that, I think it's R-424, he said that his income was $100,000.
I mean, the income's noted. The definition of protected environment falls under the general definition of marginal employment, right? It's an insight as to what constitutes marginal employment.
Correct.
That definition seems more to track the wage paid, right? Unless the sort of accommodations, meaning you wouldn't sort of define marginal employment by just looking to whether or not the amount of accommodations that is paid. Marginal employment strikes me as employment something near the poverty line. Right?
With all due respect, Your Honor, that's not consistent with the language of the regulation. It's not consistent with the regulatory history. Regulatory history was quite clear that income is not the determinative issue, and so it's not an income first test.
They mentioned family business, they mentioned shelter in place, right? I mean, shelter in place appears to be a term of art, Department of Labor, places that are exempt from the wage, FSLA laws, right? Would be a sheltered workplace.
Right.
This does seem to track, generally speaking, like a person's income or wage.
Well, I just don't see why, Your Honor, because a family business, the person could hire somebody and pay them anything they wanted. They could pay them $100,000, $500,000 a year.
Why would taxpayers? I mean, the idea, there's a policy aspect here, right, is that if a person makes a large wage and they're already in receipt of a 70, this is 4.16A, of a disability rating that already compensates them for the average loss earning capacity, what exactly are we topping up if the person already has a substantial income?
I see you're into my rebuttal time. May I answer the question?
You're not in your rebuttal.
Oh, I see. I misquoted. Yeah.
We accounted for that, but that's okay.
Okay.
Thanks for keeping track.
I apologize. So now I've lost track. I'm sorry, Judge Toth.
You know, I mean, there's a policy aspect to this question, and I guess it would be if a person is already in receipt of a relatively high income, and they're in receipt of a rating that compensates them for average loss earning capacity, what exactly is TDIU compensating for?
TDIU is compensating for the person's inability to perform the tasks required for substantially gainful employment. And in a protected work environment, it's recognized that the person can't do the tasks required for that job. The person still does, as I mentioned, have to establish that they can't perform the tasks required for any job.
I mean, so it would be wholly irrelevant if somebody makes several orders several times higher than the average income in the U.S. That would simply be a non-relevant factor.
I don't think it's irrelevant, because I do think that a high income in our economy is indicative of skills and talents and education that a person brings to the employment market. And those factors can help show why the person might be otherwise able to perform some form of substantially gainful work. So it's not irrelevant. But it's not dispositive either. What's dispositive is what is in the language of the regulation itself, which says that TDIU is for people who cannot perform the tasks required for substantially gainful work. And so if there are people, we know there are people who are still getting paid, even though they cannot perform the tasks required by work. Mr. LaBruzza is an example of this. The board agreed that he was entitled to TDIU as of the date he left his job. And so, and the uncontradicted evidence from both a vocational expert as well as medical experts in his case is that he was not able to perform the tasks required for substantially gainful work. The vocational expert said as far back to 2010.
Ms. Burkett, would you please add 8 more minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. And so yet he was getting paid something. And so what reasonable versus excessive accommodations does is resolve that tension. Why is it that some people are getting paid as if they were doing substantially gainful work, even though we know from the medical evidence that they can't? Like, it doesn't make sense. So either the medical evidence is all wrong, they really are able, although that's not what the board found in this case, or there's some other explanation. And the other explanation is that they are in a protected environment, that they are being excused from having to perform all the essential tasks of the job. And we saw that, for example, in Mr. Cantrell's case, where he was working for, I think it was a county park service, but he was a park ranger. And he wasn't in a sheltered workshop. But he was getting massive accommodations. He was permitted to take breaks whenever he wanted. He could leave the job site at the drop of a hat, even if he was in the middle of working with a visitor to the park. If he needed to leave, he was allowed to leave. They assigned people to him to help out periodically. He got massive accommodations. And eventually VA did agree that he was entitled to benefits, even during the period he was working. It's not a burden on the taxpayer, because these are, quite frankly, people who would not be working. It's a burden on the employer. That's who's bearing the burden of this, not the taxpayer.
So, Ms. Cook, let me follow up on the financial aspects here. So is there any evidence in the record other than a notation as to what Mr. LaBruzza made in 2018? Is there any other, for the other years, aren't we trying to go back to 2010?
20.
Okay, so there's like seven years unaccounted for as far as income goes?
That's correct.
Okay, and we have nothing in the record on that.
The only thing that's in the record is, like I say, I think it's at R-424. We saw part of his TAU application where on the first page he says the from in 2018 his earnings were $198,000. The very next page he says, and I think he said it was in 2017, in answer to the question, what's the maximum you've ever gotten? He said $8,500 per month, which is $102,000. So it's not clear at all, but that's the only other information. He also, on that same document, said another figure, which I couldn't read. It was too blurred and indicates he's taking – it looks like he thinks he should be allowed to take deductions, expenses off of that, which then lowered his income to 82. That
okay.
So the information is
– right. We don't have the facts about what he made during his years. Okay.
Your Honor.
So moving back to the accommodations issue, who would have the burden? I have to say, I was quite frankly surprised to read the proposed definition from both appellants' counsels, because would it be the appellant who would have to provide evidence of having been accommodated and also evidence that they were receiving excess accommodations over what the ADA requires? And what would this look like? It's not something that you typically see in a file, even a TDIU one, nothing. Okay, so what would it look like?
I think that what it would look like is that I do think that the veteran bears the initial burden of raising the issue. I don't think that the board has any obligation to parse every single line in. So there's a reasonable.
But raising the issue, you mean just applying for TDIU and saying my employment is protected, a protected environment.
I think that would be sufficient. If VA went back and said, well, what do you mean by that? Like, you know, give us some more details the way they do, for example, with people who allege that they were in combat, absent something on the actual service records.
And so you were saying Mr. Cantrell eventually received TDIU?
Yes, I think that's in the government.
Okay. So, but they're apparently with no ADA documents, or you don't know?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Uh-huh. I would bet there were no ADA documents there. That's just a wild, it's not such a wild guess. It's a guess grounded in experience. But why would you want to impose a burden like that on the veteran to, prove this when not only that they had been accommodated, but that there were excess accommodations here, especially when, as you, I think you had mentioned earlier or in one of your, maybe in your supplemental memo, a lot of times it's not the agency or the entity, the employer, who will make the accommodations. It's the immediate boss, maybe with the implicit maybe consent of the agency or the employer, but not necessarily. And so this might be evidence that a veteran would have difficulty coming up with.
Yes and no, Chief Judge Bartley. So let me just back up a little bit in terms of how I see this playing out. So first, the person is going to be applying for, filing the 8940 form with VA or alleging, I'm not able to work. And VA immediately asks for information about current work status. That's like it's right there on the 8940, and if they haven't filled out an 8940, they're expected to. And that says, are you currently working? And so it becomes an issue immediately. Well, if you're currently working, how is it that you claim TDIU? And so, yes, I do think that there is some burden on the claimant to say, at the very least, I'm in a protected environment. People are cutting me breaks, something like that. So that then the record gets developed based on that. And some of that information will come from the veteran, what his job, if the court agrees that the tasks assigned, the essential nature of the job is critical, VA would have to get that information. Could get it from the veteran, could get a copy of his job description, could get it from other co-workers, could get it from the employer, could get it from ONAD, all sorts of resources, just to find out what's going on and what is he doing. I don't see this as terribly different from what happens now in a TDIU case where a veteran who's not working says, I think I'm qualified for TDIU, and VA has him fill out the 8940, and then there's an exploration of what his skills are, what his educational background is, what is he able and not able to do. And it can happen, as we know from Ortiz-Valles, the assessment of protected work can happen even for someone who's not employed. So I'm not.
Right now, TDIU applications in general, the veteran isn't working, and I mean, I guess in some cases it might be relevant. VA might go to the employer and query, you know, what happened. But a lot of times it's based on the veteran's statement. But some kind of ADA evidence, especially that you're getting, that you have more disability than the ADA requires accommodation of, seems like a complicated kind of...
I think I've misunderstood your point, Your Honor, and I apologize. No, I'm not imposing a burden on the veteran to establish that, you know, these are reasonable accommodations, these are not reasonable accommodations. I think if VA wants to deny the claim, you know, after the veteran has described what he does, and there's information in the file as to what the job requires and what the veteran's limits are, which VA is going to get mostly from, from all the different sources of credible evidence there is, that if VA wishes to deny the claim, you know, if those two things matching up, if the tasks required exceed what the veteran's able to do, VA should grant the claim. And if they want to say, well, we think the employer could maintain that burden, then the burden would be on VA to establish that.
Okay, thank you. Well, go ahead, Judge Peach. Go ahead.
So what we have here is an individual who is working as a building inspector and is asking for TDIU for the periods that he was working as a building inspector because he says he's in a sheltered work environment. And he says he's in a sheltered work environment because they had to hire an assistant for me because I couldn't get my work done. And, you know, I do have a temper, and they said if you weren't a veteran, we'd have fired you. Now, to go back to the assistant, is it not possible that the assistant was hired because there was just too much work to do? And that they...
Thank you.
Go ahead.
I was just saying thank you to Chief Judge Bartlett for adding time. I didn't mean to interrupt you, Judge Peach. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. But so they hired an assistant for him because, in his mind, it was to accommodate him because they complained I couldn't get my work done. Maybe he couldn't get his work done because there was just too much work and they needed more staffing.
Well, that's certainly a scenario that's hypothetically possible, but it's not the evidence in this case.
Well, what is the evidence then?
The evidence in this case is that he said, I can't meet the deadlines that are required. I'm more disorganized. I just can't do this on my own, and I was falling behind. And so I hired an assistant to help me stay organized and to help me meet the deadline.
So he hired the assistant, not the employer.
I think that's what he said. I think he said that he hired the assistant.
Then the employer didn't make the accommodation.
I think it's not clear from the record, Your Honor. I would just say that when I read it, I assumed that he meant that the employer hired someone, but it doesn't. I don't think it matters. The point is that he was getting paid the same amount. He didn't identify losing money, even though he was having somebody else do some of the essential tasks of his job.
And then as to the temper and not being fired because he was a vet, could that have just merely meant that the employer was afraid to fire him because the employer might run afoul of some statutory law regarding employment of veterans?
Absolutely. And I think that proves the point that motivation can be any one of a dozen or more things. Why the employer is willing to accept those kinds of behaviors that they're not willing to accept from someone else. So, yes, the employer could be motivated by his or her mistaken belief about what the law requires. The employer could be motivated by guilt, civic pride, a desire to honor the veteran. They could be motivated by all sorts of things. So the point is,
okay.
The point is that if the person is would otherwise be fired because they're not meeting the minimum requirements of the job at issue, and yet they're not fired, they're still being paid, that's a protected environment because they're being protected from the economic consequences of not being able to do the task required.
So then to go back to what you think that might be requirements to indicate the sheltered or protected environment, in response to Judge Toth's question, I think it was pretty much agreed that income could be a criteria, not the criteria, but a criteria to consider. And that, so far, did I understand that?
I wouldn't call it a criteria. Maybe I'm, you know, I'm getting into angels dancing on the head of a pin kind of thing, but I wouldn't call it a criteria. I think it's a relevant factor.
Thank you. A relevant factor. The second relevant factor from the discussion we just had would be the kind of accommodation that was provided to the individual. And now we've added a third one, which I think I would interpret as another factor as the employer's motivation. Benevolent or something else? I mean, we don't know. Is that something to consider, the employer's motivation?
I think that motive, like income, can be relevant because one always wants to know, why is this happening? Why is this person getting paid even though they're not performing all the essential functions of the job? But none of those things are dispositive. The thing that's dispositive is there's two things that are dispositive taken together. What does the job require? What are the essential functions of the job? What are the tasks required to be performed by the job? And what are the veteran's limitations? Is the veteran able to do those? And to do those essential tasks.
But that's an ADA. He can be accommodated under ADA using that.
Yes or no? Perhaps not. If he cannot do, if the accommodations he requires, I'm calling them excessive, if to accommodate the veteran, the employer has to remove essential functions from the job, that's not a reasonable accommodation.
Thank you.
It just by definition, it's not a reasonable accommodation. And so if the employer is saying, okay, the job takes, this job requires you to do tasks 1 through 15, and the person is hired, able to do tasks 1 through 15, and does them well, but then the person's disability is aggravated, gets worse over time, and now he can only do tasks 1 through 5. He can't do 5 through 10, 5 through 15 anymore because of his service-connected disability. The employer at that point, and he can't do the additional tasks even with reasonable accommodations. He simply cannot. He can't process it, or in Mr. Labruzza's situation, he's losing his temper. He's leaving because he's afraid he's going to beat people up. I mean, he's just not doing all the tasks required. And even with reasonable accommodations, he can't do those tasks. So the employer has a choice at that point. The employer has a choice of saying, I'm letting you go. You're no longer otherwise qualified, in the words of the ADA. You don't have the ability to perform all the tasks required. So the employer could let the person go.
So
or they could keep them on.
So do you think that a job situation could morph into a protected environment? Or is it a protected environment only after he leaves and say, you know, I've got, this is what happened. In other words, could the employer sit the employee down and say, look, I think we're going to have to make the decision that we're going to put you in a protected environment or some factors or some circumstances that would indicate we're doing more than accommodating you under the ADA, but we're going to give you a protected environment. Is that something that should be factored into it, or does it just morph? Does it morph?
Maybe I'm misunderstanding your question, Judge Peach, but I think that's exactly what I'm describing, is that the employee is not, stops being able to perform all the essential functions of the job. People are not typically, other than in a sheltered workshop, which is not what we're talking about, people typically are not hired even though and paid the competitive rate, even though they cannot do the job. And so the person's hired, he can do the job, and then his disabilities worsen. And at that point, the job does morph, to use your term, into a protected environment. It hasn't always been a protected environment because for years or months or whatever, the veteran was able to perform all the essential functions of the job. But once that person stops being able to perform the tasks required by the job at issue, and the employer does not penalize the person by reducing salary or letting him go or any other way, just says, okay, we're going to, for you, we're making an exception, then that's a protected environment.
Like, an employer's willingness to overlook, you know, maybe suboptimal behavior on the job is very often an indication that the person is super talented, but very difficult to work with, right? I mean, thinking of, I mean, when you give examples, I'm thinking of professional athletes or actors or divas.
All right.
And the idea is they're so good at what they do, they're so essential at what they do, that a supervisor is willing to kind of bend over backwards and tolerate behavior that otherwise, like they wouldn't tolerate, you know. And I guess my question is kind of to Chief's point, which is, as a fact finder, I mean, this seems somewhat subjective, and it seems both difficult to prove, but also difficult to adjudicate. And how would you, I mean, what markers would you sort of provide to people who are trying to adjudicate whether or not this is like an excessive accommodation or a protected environment?
Well, I certainly agree that the employer's willingness to tolerate the behavior could be an indication of the person's value, but that's because the employer has defined what the value is. And so, you know, for the athlete, the employer just says, look, you go out and you hit, you know, 325 every season, you're good. That's fine. And the rest of it, I'll deal with. You know, the fact that you're a jerk with the media or whatever, you know, cause problems in the dugout, I'll put up with it because you hit so many home runs or whatever. So he's defining what the value is. It can be subjective. It doesn't have to be. And certainly no more subjective than what VA already does with its rating schedule. I mean, some of these cases are going to be pretty simple. Some of the accommodations that are provided are straightforward, and the EEOC has a host of examples of things, you know, providing a ramp, providing a stool for someone who needs to sit as opposed to stand. Those things are all, per se, reasonable accommodations, and the person who comes, the veteran who comes and says, that's what I need. I need a ramp. I need a TTY phone. That's it. That's all I need. That's easy. It's also going to be easy if the person does have enormous skills and talents. And I go back to the example of the brain surgeon with Parkinson's. You know, there are no doubt lots of jobs that person can do. And so there are going to be a number of easy calls. It's always going to be subject. There's always going to be some element of subjectivity, some element of objectivity. The objectivity comes from what does the job require and what are the veteran's limitations and what is he able to do and not able to do. That's very objective. But TDIU, the assessment of TDIU has always been deemed to be objective and subjective. And one has it in the rating schedule itself, not just TDIU. I mean, and at this point, without any definition whatsoever, it's totally subjective. No one knows what the rules are. But many ratings are challenging. That doesn't mean that they shouldn't take place. I mean, a rating for a psychiatric disability, as the court knows, the rules are such as. He has symptoms such as. Well, so it's not even limited to what's listed in the regulation. And so it becomes challenging, yes, for the adjudicator to figure out. But it doesn't mean that it shouldn't happen. And the ADA has been around since 1990. The Rehab Act has been around since 1973. There is obviously a ton of resources and available materials for VA to use, as well as their own in-house vocational experts if they choose. So there are ways that they can make this relatively simple.
Well, I have one last question. One last question. So you talked about the ADA part, the accommodations part, and then Judge Peach was mentioning, well, some other factors might be, and Judge Toth, the income might be another factor, and motivation of the employer or the employer in some instances. So are there other things that you would add that are missing from that list that I just listed that you think are relevant considerations in making these kinds of determinations that you didn't include in your supplemental?
Not that I can think of. I mean, for me, I see I'm out of time. May I finish the answer?
Yes.
Thank you. It's a straightforward concept that comes directly from the language of 416, which says we know that people who can do the tasks required by work, and the ADA is baked into that with reasonable accommodations, those people are not eligible. If they can't do the essential functions of the job because of their service-connected disability, then they are going to, and are getting paid, they are going to be in a protected environment. And so the questions are just, what are the tasks required? Is the person able to do it? And as I said earlier, it doesn't mean that automatically that person is entitled to TDIU because there may be other positions.
Got it. I was just wondering if there was anything else you would add.
Not that I can add in.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Cook. And Mr. Murray, you may proceed for Appellant McBride.
Chief Judge Bartley, may it please the Court. The Secretary's repeated failure to define the phrase employment in a protected environment has led to inconsistent board decisions, increased litigation, delayed benefits, and ever-moving goalposts that have forced veterans to guess what evidence is needed in order to establish a TDIU. Mr. McBride respectfully requests this Court hold that the phrase employment in a protected environment is unambiguous and means employment in which a veteran is shielded from the economic consequences of the employment marketplace. However, if this Court were to find that the phrase is genuinely ambiguous, deference is not warranted because the Secretary's definition is not reasonable, is not, and indeed cannot be, VA's official position, does not reflect fair and considered judgment, and lacks the power to persuade.
Could I just interrupt here? What is your perception of the Secretary's definition?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You had said that the phrase would be ambiguous, that the definition of protected environment. What do you perceive is their definition of protected environment?
Your Honor, the Secretary is advancing a very narrow interpretation of a protected environment, and my understanding is that they wish to define it as only including a specialized place of employment for disabled persons completely separate from the competitive marketplace and require both hiring and ongoing compensation decisions to be motivated by the employer's benevolence or altruism. And, Your Honor, if this court determines that the phrase is genuinely ambiguous, deference does not do because, you know, first of all, the Secretary's definition is unreasonable. The Secretary justifies his definition of a protected environment by referencing the much narrower terms sheltered employment and sheltered workshop that's being used by other agencies and other authorities. However, in doing so, what the Secretary is failing to recognize is that a sheltered workshop is simply one example of a protected environment.
It's a narrowing function, the margin of employment, right? I mean, protected environment is a subset of margin of employment. Right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And so, I guess another way to look at it was, I mean, is Mr. McBride's job or was Mr. McBride's job as an inventory specialist at a large defense contractor, is that substantially gainful employment? Because substantially gainful employment and marginal employment those are our two choices. And if it's substantially gainful employment, then he's precluded from TDIU. So it has to be marginal employment. So that's why, I mean, I'm tracking, isn't that the narrowing language?
It would be substantially gainful employment if Mr. McBride were able to fulfill all of the job requirements of the position and if he was not being provided employment protections greater than those required by law. But because he, you know, as his disabilities worsened, he became less and less able to fulfill the duties, such as, you know, operating a forklift or counting inventory, the BAE provided him additional protections, including hiring assistance to complete the duties that he was unable to do.
Mr. Murray, would you, having read the supplemental memo of Mr. Labruzza and the Secretary, would you say that you and Mr. Labruzza are on, at counsel for Mr. Labruzza, are on the same page as far as the definition? I have both of yours here, and they're use slightly different language, but appear to me to be very similar. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And you, although it's not in your, you start out giving a definition, sheltered from the economic consequences of being unable to obtain substantial gainful occupation. Something about the shielding. Yeah, shielding from the economic consequences you would face in the employment market, similar to what Mr. Labruzza said.
Yes, sir.
But then you both added in this accommodation issue and particularly referencing the ADA. You're on the same page as far as that goes, too. That is, a veteran would need something to show a disability that would not be that is over and above what the ADA would accommodate.
Yes, Your Honor. Because if the veteran is in receipt of if the law requires the protections that the veteran is receiving, then he's still within the open employment marketplace, and presumably the veteran would be able to find some other gainful employment that would provide the same accommodations since they are required by law.
Uh-huh. And so the evidence question that I asked Ms. Cook about, like, who proves this and how do you go about proving that you've received more than what the ADA, you have disabilities and require accommodations over and above what the ADA would accommodate, how would that, what kind of evidence would be needed?
I think the evidence could be, as in Mr. McBride's case, statements saying, these are what my job duties were or are, these are the protections or the accommodations that I'm being required. And once all of those facts are gathered, it would be up to the adjudicator to apply those facts to the law and determine whether or not the protections that have been provided are required under the ADA or another one.
Uh-huh, okay.
I guess a variation. Would it be necessary that the person receive a below market wage?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, then why not? I mean, they would be receiving exactly what a similar situated person without a disability.
Yes, Your Honor, but they would be receiving it only because they were being provided the protections, and they would...
What would they need to be compensated for? They would receive exactly what somebody else in their shoes would receive for the same work.
Yes, sir. Well, that is a policy decision that the Secretary made when he drafted the regulation. The only reference to...
environment. I mean, it's protected from what?
Protection from otherwise being rendered unable to earn an income below the poverty level. So,
the hypothetical I ask is basically, if the veteran's receiving the same wage they would otherwise receive if they weren't a veteran and weren't disabled, what would the purpose of the compensation be?
The purpose would be to compensate the veteran for otherwise being unable to find gainful employment. And, you know, again, that's a policy decision the Secretary made. He only, in the regulation, only references...
Being compensated for the loss of the average loss of earning capacity, right? I mean, that's already, we're in 4.16A, so the person's already receiving 70%. So what exactly would TDIU, and what purpose would it serve in terms of, we're trying to investigate what constitutes a protected environment, if they're receiving the same exact wage that they would if they were never disabled?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I think that we don't necessarily know what wage the veteran may earn absent the service connected disabilities and the effects that they have. You know, in Mr. McBride's case, he worked for BAE for quite a number of years, and it's entirely possible that absent his service connected disabilities,
maybe he was promoted to a different job.
Yes, Your Honor. So
have a totally different profession.
Yes, Your Honor. And his income could have been substantially more. I believe the most he had earned, he reported slightly over $38,000. And you know, after 20-plus years of working at the employer, it's possible that, you know, if he were not disabled, that he may have earned substantially more. Contrary to the Secretary's narrow definition, the scope of a protected environment is meant to be broad. And ultimately, there are just two questions that are at issue. First, is the veteran receiving employment protections beyond those required by law due to their service-connected disabilities? And absent those protections, would the veteran be unable to secure and maintain substantially gainful employment? If both are answered in the affirmative, then the veteran is employed in a protected environment, and TDIU would be warranted. Turning back to deference, the Secretary's proposal that limits a protected environment to instances in which the veteran was hired for benevolent reasons is also unreasonable, because the Secretary would ignore the fact that disabilities may develop or worsen over time well after the hiring decision was made. For example, Mr. McBride began working at BAE in 1993, and at that time he did not immediately require any accommodations to fulfill his duties. But over time, his service-connected disabilities worsened such that he required protections to allow him to retain that employment. And once BAE closed and he lost those protections, the board found that he was unemployable the very next day. And the Secretary's focus on hiring decision ignores the only thing that changed from one day to the next, and that's that Mr. McBride lost the protections that he was being provided by BAE.
So, Mr. Murray, I'm not sure I got a straight answer from you before. Do you think that if we were looking at factors that should be considered when making the protected environment determination, that income, money, salary is one of those factors?
No, Your Honor.
Not at all?
No, Your Honor. You know, as I referenced, you, for policy reasons, the Secretary chose not to include an income restriction in the regulation. And, you know, he certainly knows how to do so. If you look at 4.17, the Secretary limited marginal employment to instances in which the veteran is earning half of the usual compensation. And so, you know, if he wishes to impose an income restriction, he certainly can. But on the adjudication side, it's not necessarily the income itself that is relevant. It's what we look at the income to represent. And so, you know, such as a higher level of education or, you know, a skill level, employment history, and those are all factors that the Brewer or that the VA is already required to consider when adjudicating TDIU. So, for example, Your Honor, if you take an attorney, you know, who earns $250,000 a year, and as an attorney, we know he went to law school, so he has a very high level of education and, you know, presumably, you know, a wonderful skill set and employment history. But if you take that same veteran and say he only earns $35,000 a year, nothing has changed in his ability to find other gainful employment. And again, it doesn't necessarily, we're not necessarily saying that the veteran must be able to find similar employment or maintain his salary. It simply, you know, would not be able to find gainful employment elsewhere. And so.
Okay, so income is not on your list of factors.
No, Your Honor.
If you were writing the reg, yeah, you provided us with a draft definition, I should say, not the reg, but a draft definition. Okay, so income wouldn't be on it. So other things, accommodations made would be on there. The assessment of whether the veteran got an accommodation and whether it was over and above what would be have been required by the ADA.
Yes, Your Honor.
Due to disability. Okay. And the motivation of the employer, what, is that a factor that
it could be a factor, Your Honor, but not a dispositive factor. And you know, what the Secretary is attempting to do is make it dispositive. And you know, there are certainly other reasons that a veteran may be provided protections that extend beyond you know, the employer's benevolence or altruism. For example, a company, you know, could provide veterans, you know, protections beyond those required by law, just for marketing purposes, as it's seeking government contracts. And in that case, the motivation would be increased profit and not benevolence towards veterans. But the result remains the same, that despite the employer's intentions, the veteran is protected from the consequences of his failure to fully perform the requirements of his job, a failure that is due to service-connected disability. Looking back at deference, I see I'm just about running out of time, Your Honor. May I continue?
Yeah, you may wrap it up. Judge Peach, do you have questions? Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. The Secretary's definition is not VA's official position as is required in order to earn deference. Because the Secretary's, it may be his official legal position, but he has in no way calculated published it in the Federal Register or any other way to give the public notice of his definition. And the Supreme Court in Kaiser noted that the interpretation must use appropriate policy vehicles that are understood to make policy. And finally, Your Honor, the Secretary's interpretation does not reflect fair and considered judgment because it's merely a convenient litigating position, and in Mr. McBride's case, a post hoc rationalization. The Secretary has only advanced his definition in briefing to this court. Other parts of the agency, the Veterans Benefits Administration, has not included his definition in the M21. In preparation for our argument, sir, Your Honor, we conducted a quick survey of board decisions, and you know, the board is continuing to employ different definitions than what the Secretary is proposing.
I do have a question. I noticed that in the record, I think it was an answer to a question to Mr. McBride why he felt he was in a protected environment. He said because I had asked my employer supervisor why he hadn't fired me earlier, and the response was, well, your records has something saying you're protected.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, does that make it so then?
I guess the ultimate answer, Your Honor, is we don't know. That certainly Mr. McBride's understanding is that he was shown his HR file on a computer screen by his supervisor, and he was labeled as protected. Without more information, we certainly don't know what BAE meant by protected on his HR file. But it is certainly Mr. McBride's position that. Again, that would be evidence weighing in favor of a protected environment.
So then another factor to consider would be how the employer, what the manifestations are on the employer's part of this. So how do they view the employee? Well, he was, in this case, protected. Or in the case of Mr. LaBraza, they didn't fire him. So is the concept of protected environment one as perceived by the employer or the employee?
It would be perceived by the employer, Your Honor, because it would be the employer or potentially coworkers providing the protections. And the reason that they're providing the protection, their intent behind it is not relevant, but they are the ones providing the protections, and so it would be from their viewpoint.
What do you mean by the intent is not relevant? The intent on the employer's part?
Yes, Your Honor. So if it's benevolent intent, I'm sorry, not dispositive, not yet relevant, Your Honor. I misspoke. Mm-hmm. If the employer's motivation is for a benevolent reason, then it certainly would weigh in favor of finding a protected environment.
Going to the motivation.
Yes, Your Honor. But it's not dispositive.
Income is not dispositive either. Or I think you said you wouldn't even consider it.
Correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Okay. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Murray. And Ms. Jemison, you may go ahead.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The Secretary should prevail in this case for the following three reasons. The Secretary's interpretation of 4.16 is reasonable. The Secretary's interpretation and application of 4.16 is consistent with the purpose of the regulation. And the Secretary's interpretation should be afforded deference. The Court has previously found in Cantrell that 4.16 is ambiguous. However, the Court may still resolve that ambiguity consistent with the analysis provided in Kaiser, applying the rules of regulatory construction. In resolving that ambiguity, the Secretary's proposed interpretation of 4.16A should be adopted by the Court through one of the following three mechanisms. Yes.
I see two different justifications across the board decisions. I mean, how can you claim this is the official position of the agency, this interpretation?
Well, Your Honor, we would point to the fact that both board decisions reference the very same factors that are contained in the definition before the Court right now. For instance, Mr. McBride's case, the board found that his employment was not due to altruistic and personal reasons, and he was not provided accommodations beyond those provided by law. And for Mr. LaBruzza, the board found that he was not employed for a charitable or therapeutic purpose, and because his legally required accommodations permit him to maintain gainful employment. Both of those cases, both of those board decisions are consistent with the main factors contained in the definition before the Court right now. Both cases, the board looked for evidence that the employer's hiring decisions were made and based on a desire to help the employee, and the evidence that the employer made accommodations beyond what was required by law, which is the ADA. So because those are the core characteristics of how the Secretary interprets the term protected environment in this case, both of those board decisions are consistent with the secretary's interpretation.
So, does the definition that's provided, does that have any purchase outside of this courtroom and this litigation? I mean, is this circulated anyway within VA?
It has been circulated to the extent that obviously it was discussed with our stakeholders and throughout the agency.
Wait, did you say it wasn't?
No, it was within the agency as far as to represent our client.
Did they advise the rest of the world about this?
No, Your Honor.
Board members who make these decisions and are adjudicators? Do they use this template or are they, you know, because in our line, or was it Cantrell, it was like, hey, we'll let them do anything they want and that's the way it's supposed to be because it has to be case by case. Is that still the thinking or has this been disseminated?
It hasn't been disseminated in writing, though, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, why not?
Well, Your Honor, at this point, while the agency is in recognition of the fact that in Cantrell the court did find 4.16 to be ambiguous, unfortunately, because there have been competing interests as far as priorities for the agency to resolve, such as the PACT Act and the AMA and amendments to the scheduler criteria, they simply just have not gotten to it yet, to be honest.
Well, I find the argument about deference completely unconvincing. I don't know how you could expect any other reception here. How can we defer to something when you have not? This is not your. It's your interpretation just for purposes of litigation. You just basically said it yourself. It's not for any other purpose other than to get rid of these cases.
That is fair, Your Honor, with regard to our deference. However, we would argue that if the court were to determine that we weren't due our deference, which is the higher form before you, we would request that you consider whether or not we could be afforded Skidmore deference to the point that it is a lesser standard, and also it is essentially for the court's consideration for the propriety of the definition as well as
You're saying that this definition that you provide has the power to persuade?
Yes. Primarily because it is a reasonable definition, it's consistent with the purpose of this regulation, and it's derived from the plain language of the regulation and can be applied consistently. It's simply a more workable definition than the other two that are before you. Now, understandably, if the court were to decline to afford the secretary any deference at all, the secretary would also then request that the court consider the secretary's interpretation at the very least for advisory purposes. Again, the three interpretations in this case contain some of the same language as the court acknowledged in questioning the appellant's counsel. All three start from the proposition of protecting the disabled person from economic consequences from his or her inability to perform the requirements of their employment. However, that's where the similarities end. The definitions provided by both appellants are...
I'm going to slow you down for a second. Mm-hmm. You're right. I mean, Skidmore is sort of funny because it's not really a deference canon in the sense of if something's really persuasive, it's persuasive that's the actual textual interpretation of it. So why is your proposed definition the best? Why does it work better than what Veterans Council proposed?
Well, Your Honor, the Secretary's definition has two core features that the other two do not. First is their requirement that the employer has hired the disabled person for benevolent reasons. And second is the requirement that the employer accommodate the workplace beyond what would otherwise be legally required. Both of the appellant's definitions...
And you have another factor in there separated from the competitive workplace?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. The difference here between I'll start with Mr. McBride. Their definition is the broadest of the three before you. It simply just is anybody that's shielded from, any veteran that's shielded from the economic consequences that he or she would face in the employment market. The problem with that definition is that it's so broad that it swallows the rule. It doesn't take into account the fact that we are already looking at the exception in 4.16 as far as substantially gainful employment. So we're looking at marginal employment, and as counsel stated, they don't believe that there's any consideration for anything outside of the words that are right there. No income, no consideration for why the employer has made any accommodations.
They do start out giving that broad definition. Then, as I was saying to Mr. Murray, later they come in and say, oh, by the way, we do we're going to tack on this accommodation, consideration of the accommodations and whether the veteran has gotten needs accommodations in excess of what is required by law. That's on page 6 of their supplemental.
Yes, I would say that.
So it's not quite as broad. That's my point.
Yes, I would say that all three definitions actually do consider the fact that it does need to be above what's required by law as far as ADA. Same thing. Mr. LaBruzza's definition is obviously closer to the secretary's. I believe that the only component really missing there is regarding the component as far as the disabled person being hired for benevolent reasons. But again, the secretary is choosing to more narrowly tailor the definition to avoid the amorphous consequences that have been occurring that the court seems concerned with since the Cantrell case.
I mean, amorphous consequences. What is benevolent intentions mean? I mean, as a former criminal lawyer, I mean, intent is always the hardest thing to prove. It's always the hardest thing to deal with. How would a fact finder go about assessing benevolent intentions?
I would imagine that in developing the record, there would need to be some sort of evidence as to why the veteran was hired and their employment was maintained. So, for instance, in a situation where, because purely this definition was also considering the issue of sheltered employment and sheltered workshop and the exceptions contained therein. So one of the things that VA would be looking at is, was the employer essentially considering that this person is a veteran and making additional accommodations? So, for instance, in these particular cases, I believe that Judge Toth, you asked counsel earlier about whether or not a consideration should be made when somebody is the best and the brightest at their job. In this instance, in Mr. McBride's case, he actually said at his board hearing that he believed that part of the reason he was able to maintain his position was because he was excellent at his job. That's not necessarily a factor that shouldn't be considered. And so what we're saying is that that is something that's important for that goes toward whether or not someone is in a protected environment.
Opposing counsel a little bit of rub over the same thing, which is, why an employer might tolerate certain things is difficult to know. Why a certain situation may be acceptable to them. It's a difficult thing to ascertain, right? And it can be subjective. It can be just simply they're nice people, or it can be tethered pretty closely to specific factors. I don't see what would be necessarily distinguishable about that from Ms. Mabuza's definition. Right? It's just simply this is protecting people from the economic consequences of the disability.
I would believe that the only thing that would be determinative there as far as whether it's benevolent or not would be that in developing the claim that VA would probably have to reach out to the employer to inquire, much like the development takes place in a regular TDIU case. That's part of the reason why the veteran is asked to complete the form and provide information for whoever their last employer is. It's so that development can take place. That doesn't, of course, guarantee that anybody is going to cooperate or that any of the necessary evidence might be permitted or provided by the employer, but it does provide a goalpost as opposed to just leaving the definition so overly broad that we're still in the same situation as to why the court found 4.16 ambiguous in the first place. To that end,
any other questions, Jacob? Okay, I didn't. In your definition, you use that the protected environment is as a type of non-competitive employment. What do you mean by non-competitive employment?
Your Honor, it means that they are not put in, that the veteran would not be put in the position where he's necessarily competing with other non-veterans for that job.
Would it mean that he would have to, is it a job that he would have to apply for?
Yes.
Is it a job that he would have to take a test for? Is that a non-competitive or is that competitive? In the stereotypical protected environment, like maybe like a Goodwill, that might be considered non-competitive versus a job in the federal government, like or private industry. So what does the word non-competitive mean?
Your Honor, I think it would depend on the type of job as to whether or not there would be testing and that type of thing involved. May I ask the court's indulgence for one moment? May I confer?
Sure.
Counsel? Apologies, Your Honor. Goodwill is a perfect example of that. But as far as anything beyond that, as far as things that might be based on that person, that individual's level of knowledge or education, that would be dependent. That's still going to be kind of subjective based on the type of job it is.
So if either one of these private employers of which these appellants were employed by, if the private employer had, let us say, a rehabilitative program for the following kinds of persons, whatever they are, but disabled persons, would that be like the non-competitive versus the job where you really have to make an application, you might have to, you know, show your credentials, you might have to take a test, there may be 100 other people that you're competing against? I mean, are we looking at, in your definition, a situation where an employer has a program established as a protected environment program? I mean, using one of your phrases as non-competitive, a non-competitive position. I mean, in the federal service, you have competitive and non-competitive. They each have definitions in who falls into competitive and who doesn't fall into competitive. So under your definition, I'm trying to grasp it with what is a non-competitive position. Neither one of them, I don't know, would have been in a competitive position or non-competitive position because I don't know what it means.
I understand. One moment because I just want to make sure I understood your examples. Okay. So for the example that you provided as far as having a specific set-aside program, I think that would fall more into a shelter workshop type of situation, which certainly is protected work environment. that one is right there as an example. Mm-hmm. As far as I think what you're referring to with the federal government is like more of a competitive position versus not. There still would be some type of requirements, presumably by the employer, depending on who they are. But I think the difference might be how they view the person that they're hiring, whether or not they're planning to make some type of an accommodation versus none. And then the rest of the factors, obviously, depending on the job, would just depend on what the job is and whether they qualify it. I think there's probably some basic qualifications that all would be expected to satisfy, because obviously you can't apply to be a lawyer if you're not one. Same thing, you can't be a doctor if you're not one. But there might be some other considerations that provide accommodations to allow the person to perform the task of those jobs.
But it would be clear, I think, if the employer had a program, say federally or state funded, some sort of a vocational program that targets certain individuals with certain disabilities, and then that would make it maybe more clear as to what's competitive and non-competitive.
Yes, it absolutely would.
So, but okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
So when I read that, and I guess we all, I think the three of us had some of the same questions when we read the Secretary's definition. When I read that and reread it and then read your explanation, it kind of sounded to me like you wanted to exclude everything except a sheltered workshop-type environment and a family business. Like that, those were basically it. But with maybe a broader definition of sheltered workshop than the ones that some, I think someone included some material about how that's defined. But I mean, basically, like you I know that there are VA medical centers and things. There are people who, you know, veterans who get work and receive a lot of accommodations for it. They help people in and out of the medical center or assist in other ways. So that's not really a sheltered workshop, but it seems like it would fall under this umbrella. But almost anything else, like any competitive, most jobs you have to apply for, and here you have to apply for, and your pay is determined based on, you know, the work that you're doing. And one of the things you say here is compensation decisions, hiring and compensation decisions are motivated by benevolence. Well, that leaves out basically 99% of all employment in the U.S. Would you agree with that? Like, that's, right? I mean, most jobs are not, the hiring and the pay is not based on benevolence. It's based on, you know, competition and who can help me make the most money or do the job the best, right? So you're leaving out almost every job in the U.S., aside from these very, you know, minuscule slice of employment situations. Would you agree with that?
I would say that it does probably omit a large portion of jobs. However, the purpose of that is to kind of ensure that it's in line with the regulation, because, again, marginal employment and protected work environment are an exception. So while 4.16 generally is to compensate disabled veterans for their inability to obtain and gain and maintain substantially gainful employment, the purpose of providing compensation under protected environment is more so an acknowledgement of the fact that perhaps you can't perform and you can't necessarily do everything that you need to do that you may have otherwise been able to do but for your disabilities. So it is meant to be narrow, because while the Secretary made the policy decision to compensate people that are working, it's not meant to be so broad that it compensates everybody that's working.
Understood, and I appreciate your forthrightness about that. It would, I have to observe, this is just a casual observation, that it would be helpful if this is what VA wants as a definition to let adjudicators know so that then people like Mr. McBride or Mr. Cantrell or Mr. Labruzza who do not work for these kinds of entities would not apply, or they would challenge the reg. They would challenge the interpretation. But, I mean, you're really literally wasting their time by not limiting it, not letting everyone know that you limit it this way, right? Because if they, because I don't think that Mr. Labruzza, who worked for, you know, a local government, was, he wouldn't have applied if he had known that it has, it's solely non-competitive positions that this exception applies to. And same with Mr. McBride, same with Mr. Cantrell, apparently, although I don't know that Mr. Cantrell was high. I don't know that Mr. Cantrell, who apparently received a grant under the protected environment exception, would have actually met the definition that's here, which just goes to show that, you know, the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing in terms of VA with this. Would you agree with that?
That's pretty good.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, that's just an observation that if you're going to narrow it this way, and you've had like 6 years now, or more than that, but at least in whenever we're talking about precedent decisions that are trying to figure out what you mean by protected environment, if that is your position, it would obviate a lot of heartache and a lot of veterans struggling to prove something that they apparently cannot prove if you had just been upfront about that to begin with.
Understood, Your Honor.
So what would it take for the VA to take this definition that you've proposed and make it so? What process would you go through? I mean, obviously you've talked to stakeholders, but that doesn't seem to be enough to let us know, the world, you know, the world that we are operating in, that this is the criteria. And as the Chief pointed out, if it had been then looking at this, they would not, many, many people would not have applied. Or if they did, then at least there's a criteria that says the job you have isn't competitive, and the competitive person, it's not, you know, so on and so forth. So what would it take for the VA to adopt, adapt, implement, make it, promulgate it, whatever word. What is the process? Would you go through the rulemaking process?
Likely it would go through a rulemaking process, which unfortunately would take some time just by the nature of the beast, as it were.
6 years.
But that would probably be, based on the questions that I've received today, that would probably be the most effective mechanism to resolve the issue.
Well, what about, I mean, you may not know the answer to this, but, I mean, how big of a lift is it to provide guidance internally? Or, I mean, how much time would it take for a general counsel or the company employees or VA to provide something that could warrant deference?
Your Honor,
through your process, or, I mean, it's definitely easier than rulemaking. That's why agencies do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that something you need 3 months?
Year. Your Honor, you are correct with your assertion that I do not know the answer to that. I don't mind providing a supplemental response if the court would like one, though.
Well, Ms. Jemison, I do have a few other questions. So you referenced, I think, earlier that Mr. McBride had said in testimony, I believe, that he was very important to this entity that he worked for, and that he kept the job in part because he was more knowledgeable about certain aspects of that work area than anyone else. Now, putting aside your definition, which requires that a position be non-competitive, does the in part matter? Like, so I believe that the board decision in this case said, yeah, he was important to the agency, and so in part, that's why they kept him. And so that cuts him out of being in a protected environment. But, I mean, it was just in part. Like, if Does that distinction matter? They kept him partially because they thought he was really smart and really good at what he did, but there were other reasons, perhaps one of them being benevolence. just pure, you know, like, we're good guys, and he's a veteran, and he's having struggles, and so we're going to, you know, we're going to keep him. So does the fact that, does the fact that there might have been benevolence involved, but only in part, and that he was also retained because of his knowledge and background in the work area, why would that disqualify him from protected environment, since a portion of why they kept him was apparently because of some benevolent feeling?
If you remove the other component, then, Your Honor, I do think that that would be something that may have had more weight. However, I think that the board just essentially looked at the picture that they had before them as a whole. Unfortunately for Mr. McBride, I do believe that all they really did have before them was his testimony. So that includes that. That also includes his statement that he saw his file and it said that he was protected, which, to your point, may also have demonstrated some sort of benevolence or something. I don't know because, of course, like I said, he just the only evidence in his particular case was just what he said. But to answer your question, I do think that that was a factor that the board properly considered, and they needed to consider that in addition to whatever else he said during his testimony.
Mm-hmm.
Absent a definition or a guidance, what are your thoughts about factors to be considered, such as income or motivation or the accommodations?
Well, Your Honor, I do think that the accommodations are relevant. I think that all the parties agree on that. I do believe that the factor of the purpose of the hiring and the maintaining the employment is relevant to protected work environment, as indicated in our definition. With regard to income, I do think that that is an important factor that could be considered. So obviously, if the court was looking for a list of non-exhausted factors, similar to what Chief Judge Bartley provided in the dissent in Arline, those are things that could be considered and may provide a little bit more clarity in the adjudication of the claims, simply for the purposes of informing the veteran, maybe not with such big words, what it is that's being looked for.
You know, Mr. Murray made an interesting point about the income issue, which is that, like, VA, the way the reg is written, you could have added in a limit, an upper limit. Like, oh, you know, you can make more than, basically what the reg says, you make more than the poverty threshold. But they didn't cap that in any way. So, I mean, VA had the opportunity to do that. So why should a cap of some sort, and it's unclear what that would be, why should that be read in?
Well, Your Honor, we're not saying that you have to read in a cap. What we're saying is that it could be considered as a factor when you're looking at whether or not accommodations are made and what kind of accommodations are made. Obviously, that also plays into what kind of employment we're talking about. Because obviously, if we're talking about someone like in Judge Peach's example regarding someone that works at Goodwill, let's say, you wouldn't have the expectation that they're making $100,000. Now, if they are, great. But if they're a greeter, I would not have that expectation, just realistically. But in light of the fact that there's actually no limitation on what kind of job that we're referring to in these situations, the secretary's policy decision not to cap it kind of falls in line with that. But our position is really also that income is important here because depending on how much the income is as a factor, it does demonstrate how quickly the exception can swallow the rule of marginal employment and compensating the veteran, the whole purpose for 4.16 in the first place.
And I believe that Judge Lance and Cantrell mentioned the showing of lost income. What is VA's position on that?
Honestly, Your Honor,
is that a factor?
We have not considered that to be a factor. Uh-huh. If the court were to consider that as a factor, I don't think VA would oppose it. But again, some of the income inquiry is a factor, not the determinative factor is how we're looking at it, only because, as you pointed out, the secretary did choose not to put a cap or reference income when discussing protected work environment because it is the exception to the rule. So that wouldn't necessarily be veteran-friendly to force a veteran to have to demonstrate loss of income.
Okay.
If there are no further questions.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Jemison.
Thank you.
And Ms. Cook, you may move ahead with rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The Secretary's main argument is that his definition is reasonable, but it is absolutely not reasonable because it's contrary to the plain language of the rule itself. He essentially limits the concept of a protected environment to sheltered, putting employment in a family business into that category. At pages 5 and 6 of the supplemental pleading, he says employment in family business is best interpreted as having the same characteristics as a sheltered workshop. It basically does away with all the language of what is truly an open-ended, it doesn't have to be excessively broad, but is an open-ended definition in the regulation, given the words including and such as. And then he just adds criteria that are simply not there in the face of the regulation. It's also not consistent with the purpose of the regulation, and that purpose, I think we all agree, is that it is to compensate all persons who cannot perform the acts required by substantially gainful work. We're not seeking to compensate everyone who's working, as the Secretary seemed to think, but just those who cannot do substantially gainful work because of their service-connected disabilities. And one of the questions you asked, Judge Toth, was, and correct me if I'm misquoting you, but that what is the veteran being compensated for when he's working and if he then also gets TDIU? I think the answer to that is that he's being compensated for the fact that he or she does not have the ability to do substantially gainful work. And so in that regard, that person is in the same, exact same position as someone who is not in a protected work environment.
We're definitely circling around this, but I mean, your argument is the high income, right? Because that's part of the high problem. The high income's irrelevant.
I don't think it's irrelevant. I think it's a factor. I think it relates directly to a person who gets a high income. Often it means that the person has a lot of skills, they're in a unique position, and often it's going to mean that even though they are in a protected work environment for employer A, that they nonetheless have the ability to do substantially gainful work for employer B. And so they're not going to be eligible for TDIU. But denying that person, if they really cannot do substantially gainful work of any kind, but are nonetheless being paid by some employer in what appears to be a protected environment, then to deny that person TDIU punishes the veteran for the employer's generosity. It's not something that's being carried on the back of the taxpayers. That's a person who, if they are denied TDIU because of that employment, will leave the employment, will leave the job. They will still collect TDIU because they are not able to do substantially gainful work. But in response to your earlier question, Chief Judge Bartley, about factors, I would agree with all the factors you outlined in your opinion in our line. I would add skills. I think skills could be a relevant factor. I'm not sure that was in the list. But based on this, unless there are further questions, I ask the court to order the VA to interpret and order VA to uniformly apply an interpretation of work in a protected environment as including one where the veteran receives excessive accommodations, that is, those that are not required by law, and remand Mr. LaBruzza's case for consideration of under those factors.
Thank you, Ms. Cook. Mr. Murray?
Thank you, Your Honor. I wanted to address a couple of things that the Secretary's counsel mentioned in her argument. First, she argued that the definition that the board used in Mr. McBride's case is essentially the same definition that the Secretary is advancing now. And I wanted to point out that argument is a complete about-face from the argument that the Secretary advanced in briefing. In the Secretary's responsive brief, the Secretary stated, quote, a plain reading of the board's decision indicates that the board did not require evidence limited to that of altruism. And I believe that goes, you know, towards the inconsistency of the Secretary's position through not just during this litigation, but in the 6 years since Cantrell is that, you know, the Secretary seems to move the goalpost at will in order to give the illusion of consistency and fair and considered judgment. And we do ask that the court not permit him to do so. With respect to Skidmore deference, I just would like to note that the Secretary's definition does not flow from a natural reading of protected environment. Essentially, the Secretary is attempting to pigeonhole a protected environment into a sheltered workshop. The Secretary, even in supplemental memo, even stated that a family business in the regulation is best interpreted as having the same characteristics as a sheltered workshop. And so, you know, the Secretary is essentially trying to write out the rest of the regulation other than a sheltered workshop. Just to follow up on your question, you know, is what are we compensating here? And earlier I did mention that, you know, it could be lost opportunity, but also it's important to remember that veterans in a protected environment are essentially unable to find gainful employment elsewhere. So they are essentially stuck in that position, and they being compensated for, you know, an inability to switch jobs would be another potential reason for compensation. And then finally, you know, the Secretary mentioned that Mr. McBride has stated that he was retained in part because he was the best and brightest of the job at his job. But if that were a dispositive factor, as the Secretary seems to suggest, then Mr. McBride, if he were so wonderful at his job, he would have been able to find gainful employment elsewhere. And when BAE closed, he tried to find gainful employment. He was unable to, and the board found him to be unemployable. And so the fact that in part he perceived that he was being retained because he was best and the brightest is not dispositive in this case. I also wanted to note, you know, the Secretary noted that, you know, all the evidence that we have are Mr. McBride's statements. And, you know, I'd like to note that, you know, the board has issued 3 decisions in his case, and at no time has the board questioned his competency or credibility to offer that evidence. And so it should be considered implicitly credible under Miller. Um, And there are no questions. This court should reject this. Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. We ask that this court reject the Secretary's narrow definition and interpret the phrase employment in a protected environment as broadly requiring only that a veteran be in receipt of employment protections beyond those required by law due to service-connected disabilities, and absent those protections, he would be unable to maintain gainful employment. And finally, regardless of the court's decision as to the interpretation of the phrase, remand is necessary, and Mr. McBride's appeal is outlined in his brief.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Murray.
You.
And the court thanks all the parties and counsel very much for your arguments. The case is submitted for consideration, and we will adjourn, and the judges will come down and greet counsel.
All rise.
Thank you.